Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And it's all about full compliance with the Constitution. We spent an entire day yesterday going over a few different issues from unconstitutional executive actions as well as unconstitutional jurist actions. But what we really need to focus on are these ratification debates, because, folks, when you start understanding how the Constitution, these clauses were defined, then you have to start scratching your head and go, what the heck? Where's the disconnect here? How come these people aren't doing that? How come they don't know what they're supposed to do and what they can't do? Why are they doing these things? So, again, good old Jerry Winstrand is out there doing a campaign in the Missouri race for auditor. He could really appreciate your help, folks. I just leave it at that. We got a lot of ground to cover for the year, and we're about halfway through. We just went over that mark, I think, but nevertheless, welcome back, Sean. How you doing?
Good to be here, sir. Doing well. It's blessed every moment.
Yeah, it's probably, you know, nice and balmy down there in New Orleans.
What?
Yeah, it's the time of year where people go other places. So I'm looking at the heat, and I know what it's like in the South or over on the East Coast and so forth. It's the term comes to mind is steamed vegetables. When it's that humid and that hot, it's just steamed vegetables. That's all I feel like. Anyway, we're now hitting Madison and Madison's comments. And so we just kind of wrapped up Governor Randolph's comments. And so we are on, we are on page 47, and this is the first note of Madison's. There's a whole bunch of things Madison covers. Now, so the way they were debating, they weren't going through it the way they agreed, and I think I told you this. They were going to go point by point, one line at a time, and what ended up happening is somebody would read a line, and then they'd start injecting things that they cherry-picked, either ahead or going back on issues and so forth. So it got really frustrating. But in the very beginning, you know, they were doing everything they could to address each of the issues. And so you can see how Madison kind of goes through a bunch of different points in covering encroachments, exclusive legislation, the militia, jurisdiction, amendments, on and on and on. Money. He covers a lot of stuff in this oration. It's a long one. And so one of the things you'll notice is that there's this comment. I'm not sure if you saw this, but this is common with Madison. It says, but he spoke so low that his exordium could not be heard distinctly. So they just picked it up where they could start hearing it when he finally started speaking, or when they finally could, you know, make sense of what he was saying. And so we have no idea what they missed. Have no idea what they missed. But there's a lot of stuff that's gold here. So let's go ahead and dive into this.
I shall not attempt to make impressions by any ardent professions of zeal for the public welfare. We know the principles of every man will and ought to be judged not by his profession and declarations, but by his conduct. By that criterion, I mean in common with every other member to be judged. And should it prove unfavorable to my reputation, yet it is a criterion from which I will by no means depart. Comparisons have been made between the friends of this Constitution and those who oppose it. Although I disapprove of such comparisons, I trust that in point of truth, honor, candor, and rectitude of motives, the friends of this system here in other states are not inferior to its opponents. But professions of attachment to the public good and comparisons of parties ought not to govern or influence us now. We ought, sir, to examine the Constitution on its own merits solely. We are to inquire whether it will promote the public happiness. Its aptitude to produce this desirable object ought to be the exclusive subject of our present researches. In this pursuit, we ought not to address our arguments to the feelings and passions, but to those understandings and judgments which were selected by the people of this country to decide this great question by calm and rational investigation. I hope that gentlemen, in displaying their abilities on this occasion, instead of giving opinions and making assertions, will condescend to prove and demonstrate by a fair and regular discussion. It gives me pain to hear gentlemen continually distorting the natural construction of language, for it is sufficient if any human production can stand a fair discussion. Before I proceed to make some additions to the reasons which have been adduced by my honorable friend over the way, I must take the liberty to make some observations on what was said by another gentleman, Mr. Henry. He told us that this Constitution ought to be rejected because it endangered the public liberty, in his opinion, in many instances. Give me leave to make one answer to that observation. Let the dangers which his system is supposed to replete with be clearly pointed out. If any dangerous and unnecessary power be given to the general legislature, let them be plainly demonstrated, and let us not rest satisfied with general assertions of danger without examination. If power be necessary, apparent danger is not a sufficient reason against conceding them. He has suggested that licentiousness has seldom produced the loss of liberty, but that the tyranny of rulers has almost always affected it.
Okay, so isn't that interesting how he has called, and he's recognizing the fact that they're not coming up with arguments. They're coming up with opinions and assertions without any founded support or any tangible issues, like he just said, you know, plainly point to where the danger is. What power concerns you? And how? How is that power, in the way it's being granted, a problem for you? So now he goes into encroachments. Go ahead.
Since the general civilization of mankind, I believe there are more instances of the abridgment of the freedom of the people by gradual and silent encroachments of those in power than by violent and sudden usurpations. But on a candid examination of history, we shall find that turbulence, violence, and abuse of power by the majority trampling on the rights of the minority have produced factions and commotions which in republics have more frequently than other cause produced despotism. If we go over the whole history of ancient and modern republics, we shall find their destruction to have generally resulted from those causes.
Good, giving them a little history lesson. And so obviously, we skip down a little bit. We go down further where he talks a little bit about the exclusive legislation. Now, folks, exclusive legislation is in Article 1, Section 8 at the very bottom. They just started. This is his first oration. And this only proves that they were skipping all over the place trying to come, oh, there's this and there's this and there's this. And again, they're making general assertions. There's going to be a point in time where George Mason makes the assertion that this general legislation is going to basically lead to dark magic and the stirring of evil cauldrons in the District of Columbia. I mean, he uses the word cauldron. If that's not hyperbole and not, you know, really dissecting how this is a real problem. And ultimately, George Mason, after wrestling with Madison, comes and says, yeah, okay, you're right, but it still opens that door. And again, as this has been brought up already in several ratification debates that we've read, that whenever power is given, of course, that power can be abused. It can be abused. But we're supposed to keep checks on that. And they talk about that. But anyway, let's go to the exclusive legislation here. Thank you. You got a comment?
Yeah, next subjects to the exclusive legislation over the district where the seat of government may be fixed. Would he submit that the representatives of this state should carry on their deliberations under the control of any other member of the union? If any state had the power of legislation over the place where Congress should fix the general government, this would impair the dignity and hazard the safety of Congress. If the safety of the union were under the control of any particular state, would not foreign corruption probably prevail? In such a state, to induce it to exert its controlling influence over the members of the general government. Gentlemen cannot have forgotten the disgraceful insult which Congress received some years ago, when we also reflect that the previous session of particular states is necessary before Congress can legislate exclusively anywhere. We must, instead of being alarmed at this part, heartily approve of it.
Okay, so he's bringing up again that it's already been brought up in other states, how Congress, Continental Congress, was basically ran out of Pennsylvania because the local government, because they had access to them and so forth, weren't protecting them, and they weren't happy with what they were doing. And so this is why they need to have this insulation, this separation from being under the control of another government. Now, the militia is a really big topic in Virginia. And interestingly enough, if anybody's following what's going on in Virginia, they're right now doing a massive, you know, Second Amendment, you know, bulldozing over the Second Amendment and the 14th Amendment in Virginia. So let's go ahead and dive into the militia comment here. Go ahead.
But the honorable member sees great danger in the provision concerning the militia. This I conceive to be an additional security to our liberty without diminishing the power of the states in any considerable degree. It appears to me so highly expedient that I should imagine it would have found advocates even in the warmest friends of the present system. The authority of training the militia and appointing the officers is reserved to the states. Congress ought to have the power to establish a uniform discipline throughout the states and to provide for the execution of the laws, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. These are the only cases wherein they can interfere with the militia, and the obvious necessity of their having power over them in these cases must convince any reflecting mind. Without uniformity of discipline, military bodies would be incapable of action. Without a general controlling power to call forth the strength of the Union to repel invasions, the country might be overrun and conquered by foreign enemies. Without such a power to suppress insurrections, our liberties might be destroyed by domestic faction and domestic tyranny be established. The honorable member then told us that there was no instance of power once transferred being voluntarily renounced. Not to produce European examples, which may probably be done before the rising of this convention, have we not seen already in 7 states, and probably in an 8th state, legislatures surrendering some of the most important powers they possessed? But, sir, by this government, powers are not given to any particular set of men. They are in the hands of the people, delegated to their representatives, chosen for short terms, to representatives responsible to the people, and whose situation is perfectly similar to their own. As long as this is the case, we have no danger to apprehend. When the gentleman called our recollection to the usual effects of the concession of powers and imputed the loss of liberty generally to open tyranny, I wish he had gone on farther. Upon his review of history, he would have found that the loss of liberty very often resulted from factions and divisions, from local considerations which eternally led to quarrels. He would have found internal dissensions to have more frequently demolished civil liberty than a tenacious disposition of rulers to retain any stipulated powers.
Okay, so as he kind of lays out, you know, again, it says he's kind of repeating. And again, who do you think he's talking to here?
I'm not sure.
For the most part, he's talking to Patrick Henry. And it kind of, if you look, I mean, the convention just started, right? And Mr. Harrison spoke, Mr. Harrison Archibald, then Henry moved, and then Pendleton, then Henry withdrew his motion, and then Nicholas then spoke, Henry, Randolph, Mason, and then Mr. Madison. That was kind of his very, very first oration. And then, you know, it's kind of like ending up the day. And then now we're down to, you know, the next, let me see, that was Madison there. So, yeah, this is like 2 days later. And so Henry's kind of been stoking the fire. Henry stoked the fire earlier, the day before. And so Madison is just now finally getting up to speak to address that of what he said the day before. So he goes on here and he says, and you see the note here, Mr. Madison enumerated the various means by which nations had lost their liberties. Gave him a history lesson. And then he goes in a little bit further on the militia with all this red and blue highlights and so forth. So let's wrap up this part of the militia here. So it's right below what you just read.
Okay. The power of raising and supporting armies is exclaimed against as dangerous and unnecessary. I wish there were no necessity of vesting this power in the general government. But suppose a foreign nation to declare war against the United States. Must not the general legislature have the power of defending the United States? Ought it be known to foreign nations that the general government of the United States of America has no power to raise and support an army, even in the utmost danger, when attacked by external enemies? Would not their knowledge of such a circumstance stimulate them to fall upon us? If, sir, Congress be not invested with this power, any powerful nation, prompted by ambition or avarice, will be invited by our weakness to attack us, and such an attack by disciplined veterans would certainly be attended with success, when only opposed by irregular, undisciplined militia. Whoever considers the peculiar situation of this country, the multiplicity of its excellent inlets and harbors, and the uncommon facility of attacking it, however much he may regret the necessity of such power, cannot hesitate a moment in granting it. One fact may elucidate this argument. In the course of the late war, when the weak parts of the Union were exposed, and many states were in the most deplorable situation by the enemy's ravages, the assistance of foreign nations was thought so urgently necessary for our protection that the relinquishment of territorial advantages was not deemed too great a sacrifice for the acquisition of one ally. This expedient was admitted with great reluctance, even by those states who expected advantages from it. The crisis, however, at length arrived when it was judged necessary for the salvation of this country to make certain cessions to Spain. Whether wisely or otherwise is not for me to say, but the fact was that instructions were sent to our representatives at the court of Spain to empower him to enter into negotiations for that purpose. How it terminated is well known. This fact showed the extremities to which nations will go in cases of imminent danger and demonstrates the necessity of making ourselves more respectable. The necessity of making dangerous cessions and of applying the foreign aid ought to be excluded.
Okay, so I think he makes a very good point that, you know, this national defense thing isn't something to be trifling with, because if you don't, I mean, this goes back to some of the more recent history where, you know, peace through strength, right? Who was that? What president said that?
Reagan.
There you go. The fact that they were, you know, not caring about a national security. This goes back to the paradigm that we'll take care of ourselves, let everybody else take care of themselves. Well, the fact was that because they were so fragmented, Britain was able to land into Massachusetts and get a toehold in New York, and everywhere they went, they were able to get a toehold. and just due to the fact that we just didn't have a good national force to be ready and repel them. And there's no doubt in my mind that this whole concept of this militia was divine, because it actually set the stage for the states to transition themselves into a truly more of a self-governing, self-enforcement system, instead of trusting and being lazy like the Britain, and allowing the king to create laws and enforce those laws until you finally said, that's too much tyranny. When you create a mercenary force in enforcing laws, you open the door for your government to actually start making laws that they don't have the power to make, and then they start enforcing them. That's exactly what we're dealing with today. So, anyway, let's go down to the next one on jurisdiction. Now, this actually is short, same thing with the amendments and so forth. And let me see here. Let's just go ahead and kind of peruse through these next three sections of jurisdiction, amendments to the state structure, enumerated the amendments and the state structure, and then the enumerated jurisdiction and confederalism. Thanks.
I confess to you, sir, were uniformity of religion to be introduced by this system, it would, in my opinion, be ineligible. But I have no reason to conclude that uniformity of government will produce that of religion. This subject is, for the honor of America, perfectly free and unshackled. The government has no jurisdiction over it. The least reflection will convince us there is no danger to be feared on this ground. Amendments in state structure. But we are flattered with the probability of obtaining previous amendments. This calls for the most serious attention of this House. If amendments are to be proposed by one state, other states have the same right and will also propose alterations. These cannot but be dissimilar and opposite in their nature. I beg leave to remark that the governments of the different states are in many respects dissimilar in their structure. Their legislative bodies are not similar. Their executive are more different. In several of the states, the first magistrate is elected by the people at large, and others by joint ballot of the members of both branches of the legislature, and in others in other different manners. This dissimilarity has occasioned diversity of opinion on the theory of government, which will, without many reciprocal concessions, render a concurrence impossible. Although the appointment of an executive magistrate has not been thought destructive to the principles of democracy in many of the states, yet in the course of debate, we find objections made to the federal executive. It is urged that the president would degenerate into a tyrant. I intended, in compliance with the call of the honorable member, to explain the reasons of proposing this Constitution and develop its principles, but I shall postpone my remarks till we hear the supplement which, he has informed us, he intends to add to what he has already said.
Okay, keep going. Thank you.
Give me leave to say something of the nature of the government and to show that it is safe and just to vest it with the power of taxation. There are a number of opinions, but the principal question is whether it be a federal or consolidated government. In order to judge properly of the question before us, we must consider it minutely in its principal parts. I conceive myself that it is of a mixed nature. It is in a manner unprecedented. We cannot find one express example in the experience of the world. It stands by itself. In some respects, it is a government of a federal nature. In others, it is of a consolidated nature. Even if we attend to the manner.
So with that, I'm sorry. We obviously need to pick this back up. And as a matter of fact, I wanted to make a point out of the mixed nature and so forth. So when we come back, we'll pick it back up again. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so what you just read, Sean, was actually a perfect spot to stop, because I have said this in so many different ways, and as he's talked about these different forms of government, even at the federal government itself, it is so different. And so just to highlight this one part that you had just read right before we went into break, he said, I conceive myself that it is of a mixed, he's talking about the federal government under this new constitution, it is of a mixed nature. It is in a manner unprecedented. We cannot find one express example in the experience of the world that is going to be like this government by being able to break the overall single magistrate. Because governments prior to this had a single magistrate, whether you had a king, you had an emperor, you have, you know, a single leader. If it's a theocracy, then you have a prophet and or, you know, some religious leader. But you don't, there's never been this idea of taking the roles of what a magistrate or a king does and break that down into executing the laws, doling out justice in controversies, because that's all the federal court does. And then you have the making of laws, you know, the taxation, all of those types of things under legislation. And by breaking that out, it allows better scrutiny. It allows the checks, balances. Obviously, that in itself is the separations of power. And so he goes on in here and he talks about, you know, because I'm not sure how many times you've had conversations with people, but have you ever heard anybody say that the Constitution is, you know, it's the people's Constitution, that we, the people, foreordained, established, and ratified this?
Yes, I have heard people say that.
Now, Madison kind of clarifies that, because it's really not a consolidated, like we have one large democracy. And so in the green, this is where he goes into that. So you'll actually be covering that. But why don't you go ahead and pick it up, you know, from it stands by itself, and in some respects, it's a government of a federal nature, blah, blah, blah. Thank you so much.
It stands by itself. In some respects, it is a government of a federal nature. In others, it is of a consolidated nature. Even if we attend to the manner in which the Constitution is investigated, ratified, and made the act of the people of America, I can say, notwithstanding the honorable gentleman, what the honorable gentleman has alleged, that this government is not completely consolidated, nor is it entirely federal. Who are the parties to it? The people, but not the people as composing one great body, but the people as composing 13 sovereignties. Were it, as the gentleman asserts, a consolidated government, the assent of a majority of the people would be sufficient for its establishment. And as a majority have adopted it already, the remaining states would be bound by the act of the majority, even if they unanimously reprobated it. Were it such a government as is suggested, it would be now bound binding on the people of this state, without having had the privilege of deliberating upon it. But, sir, no state is bound by it, as it is, without its own consent. Should all the states adopt it, it will be then a government established by the 13 states of America, not through the intervention of the legislatures, but by the people at large. In this particular respect, the distinction between the existing and proposed governments is very material. The existing system has been derived from the dependent derivative authority of the legislatures of the states, whereas this is derived from the superior power of the people. If we look at the manner in which alterations are to be made in it, the same idea is in some degree attended to. By the new system, a majority of the states cannot introduce amendments, nor are all the states required for that purpose. 3/4 of them must concur in alterations. In this, there is a departure from the federal idea. The members to the National House of Representatives are to be chosen by the people at large, in proportion to the numbers in their respective districts. When we come to the Senate, its members are elected by the states in their equal and political capacity. But had the government been completely consolidated, Senate would have been chosen by the people in their individual capacity in the same member as the members of the other house. Thus, it is of a complicated nature, and this complication, I trust, will be found to exclude the evils of absolute consolidation as well as of a mere confederacy. If Virginia were separated from all the states, her power and authority would extend to all cases. In like manner, were all powers vested in the general government, it would be a consolidated government. But the powers of the federal government are enumerated. It can only operate in certain cases. It has legislative powers on defined and limited objects, beyond which it cannot extend its jurisdiction.
Well, I think that kind of sums it up right there. Beyond which it cannot extend its jurisdiction. So there's a lot here. And in all fairness, going up to that part you read, so who are the parties to it? The people? Now, see, that's what Henry brought up the day before. He looked at that we the people and says, hey, this reeks of a democracy. And everybody in the room, is this a democracy? And, you know, because maybe so many people aren't so literate. You got to remember, you have bright bulbs and you have dim bulbs, and then you just have dead bulbs. And one wouldn't think that you'd have dead bulbs in these types of debates, but when it breaks down by county and you have two or three delegates, and you may not have a lot of people. I mean, I look at it in America today, and let me ask you this, because this became a philosophical question when I first got involved in radio. There are... Let's kind of agree that we have maybe 270 million people in America that are citizens, maybe less than that, maybe 250, something like that, okay? 250 million. Let's bring it down to a nice even number. So, because there's a lot of, it's easily 50 million illegals or invaders, and then we have other people that have been brought here as refugees that are in that same process, but they're not invaders, but they're equally here unconstitutionally. And so there's a lot of people that don't belong here. And let's just say if they actually did what they were supposed to do and remove these people, and we would be down to 250 million. Well, that's probably including children and everything else, so that's not voters. But the point is out of that 250 million, give me a percentage of how many people in America understand the nuts and bolts of the Constitution the way we're going through it.
10%.
10%? Wow.
And that's a lot.
That's a huge amount. Because, see, this this is why every time I bring this up, it becomes this interesting discussion and debate. Because I say it's not even one. I don't know very many people that have gone through and even understand the militia to the level that we cover, that understand the restrictions placed upon the states or even the federal government, like the slave trade, and even understanding the compromise of the slave trade. Because they don't teach it. And as a matter of fact, many lawyers and judges aren't even taught this stuff. And so if you ponder, and I would just say, think about this and, you know, give it some real thought of the level of the, how we dive into the Constitution, you know, obviously like with the militia and the Department of Defense. I mean, clearly there's no authority in the Constitution to allow the federal government to deploy the federalized army off of the U.S. soil. And yet we have, you know, Army and Air Force stations all around the world. And they've actually gone and fought and died on foreign soil. As we've read through this, and we're going to read through this soon, that you're going to hear these men say, we don't want our militia, we don't want this federal army to be fighting across this nation. You know, we don't want them to be deployed for long periods of time out of state. They didn't give the federal government the ability to take them outside the nation, but clearly we're going to see that the anti-federalists were, you know, very loud about the fact that they could be gone out of the state for, you know, up to 2 years. That's just unacceptable. You know, who's going to plant their crops? There's been no amendment to the Constitution to basically expand. What they've done is they've passed acts. And all of them have been unconstitutional, making changes, undermining the militia system, and letting the federal government take and seize full control over something that they're not to have control over. So my point is that if you go and you hit up any military officer, I would basically say you'd be lucky if you got 1% of them that would get it right. I would basically say that we're in a club. The people that listen to this show and actually are reading and actually, you know, diving into this, getting elbows deep into the nuts and bolts of the Constitution, we're in a club that is probably less than 0.1%. Because what is 0.1% of 250 million?
Is it 2,500 or less than that, more than that probably?
Yes, yeah. So... I mean,
but that wouldn't surprise me because, I mean, when you think about it, and I mean, I just threw a number out there to keep the conversation going. But
yeah, I know that. I understand that.
The constitutional lawyers don't operate on the constitutional principles. They operate on precedent and Supreme Court case law. They could care less about the Constitution.
Right. Right. So if you do, 250 million times 0.001, that would be 1/10, right?
I was an English teacher.
Okay. So that would be 1/10. So 1/10 of 250 million would be 250,000 people. That's a lot of people. I mean, yeah. I would be proud. I would be very proud if this audience was that high. I'd be very proud
if we had that many people that really understood the Constitution, we wouldn't be in the situation that we're in.
But my point is 0.1%. Boy, if we could just have 0.1%. Wow, what league of statesmen we would have. People standing up and saying, you can't do that. There's no authority in that Constitution for you to have that Department of Transportation. See, you know, I guess a lot of people just look at me because every time I open my mouth, that guy's just a buzzkill. He just attacks all of our government. You know, he has nothing better to do. And you know what? It's not that anybody, there's nobody that can prove me wrong. I mean, there may be some points that I might utter. That I might utter out of hand that, okay, let me correct that. You know, that may be the case in some situations where I would just kind of, you know, be broad brushing and sweeping. But when it comes down to the point, the Department of Transportation is a direct violation. It's a usurpation of power not delegated. Prove me wrong. You know, so I you know, when I know I'm going to be in the point of, you know, being proved wrong, I can clarify the language so I can dent it so that there's just no way they can prove me wrong. And you would think that most patriots, and as a matter of fact, this goes back to a conversation we had before. I would think that the kids today would eat up this show because they've got to be looking at what the heck's happening to their country. You know, there are all these kids that are completely immersed, you know, and they're being destroyed by the dysphoria and the indoctrination and so forth. But I believe that there are good kids across America. We could probably find that 250,000 in junior highs and high schools in rural America where these kids, you know, they go to church, they pray, they at least pray, you know, over their food. You know, they have a similitude of morals that, you know, they look at what's going on and they go, man, this just doesn't make sense. The fact that if they knew the truth, boy, they would just have, you know, because they got the energy to actually go out into the streets and actually start, you know, making the ruckus of saying, we want our country back. And actually, instead of going into the streets, now they understand they need to go into the halls of legislation. They need to be in the legislative, you know, halls, so, you know, in front of their county legislators and state legislators and say, look, you need to start doing your job. Wow, what a world that would be if all of a sudden our children woke up and then started scolding their parents to go, you know, I can't believe you just allowed this to get this way and you never challenged anything. I remember I did a show in 2013, 2014. It was my very first show that I was solo. And I've, you know, at this point in time in my life, I was working full time, you know, had lots of responsibilities. And I was trying to write books. So I was working literally around the clock. And I just didn't have time. So I never did show prep. I started doing radio without learning to do show prep. And I've just never learned to do it ever. I've just wanted to cover the topics. We dive in, we read things and so forth. But in this fervor show, you know, I found myself at a point where I really needed to reach down and, you know, and say some things that were really needed to be articulated, but I didn't know what and how. And it ultimately came out that I said, you know, God help us if the day comes when your children are seeing, you know, the destruction of this nation, you know, while, you know, they're still living in your home and they're old enough to understand what's going on and they're old enough to know and see that you've done nothing. And how are you going to even try to defend yourself when they ask you, why did you let this happen? Why didn't you do something? Well, I didn't know what to do. I mean, what kind of defense is that? As a matter of fact, you know, is that how we're raising our children? Are we raising our children to be, you know, that complacent? I'm hoping not. But I'm hoping that we don't have to face those decisions. I'm hoping that we start realizing this is not rocket science. It's contract law. If it's in the contract, they can do it. If it's not in the contract, they can't do it. And the contract being the Constitution. So anyway, so Madison then starts talking about this, and this goes into this whole concept in the green when you hit this, because I wanted to hit this. Remember, we talked about this new form of republicanism. This line right here, this couple of lines, who are the parties to it? The people, but not the people as composing to one great body, but the people as composing 13 sovereignties. And it was that right there that helped me clue, because they talk a lot about sovereignties, legislation as legislators as sovereigns. And so as we look,
we see two bodies of legislatures or legislators in Congress, right? There's the Senate and there's the House of Representatives. That's two bodies of different sovereigns. Sovereigns that are representing the states as sovereigns and sovereigns that are representing the people as sovereigns. And so remember you asked me and we started diving in and I think we're at a point where I think you understand our form of republicanism. Our form of republicanism is not the representation of people. It's the representation of the sovereignty that has been established. We the people, as well as the governments that we've instituted, that they have representation in that next government up, that actually it is our governments that are basically the sponsors, because when you look at the federal constitution, the states sponsored the delegates to go into a convention to create the constitution for the federal government. And that's what happened in most all the states after the constitution was ratified. So it's not like the people, you know, all the people in the state or the territory got in their wagons and on their horses and set up big campfires around this, you know, big meadow where they could all talk. Because there was no building in America or in any of these territories that could house that kind of people. And there was no, you know, motels and hotels. So they were out there camping. That didn't happen. They sent a body of the most abled and the brightest people that they possibly could. I'll bet you many of them wish, boy, we really need a Madison. We don't have one. But, you know, well, we have to send what we got because you got what you've been given. And so as we look and as we see, I can see how, you know, things, so we struggled. But boy, to think that we're this 250 years after the Declaration of Independence, and they still, the communists have still not been able to pull the rug completely out from underneath us. With all of their attempts and everything that they've done, it's still withstanding that because of its design. So anyway, but back to this republicanism, I mean, it starts to make sense, right?
For sure.
But this was the line that, you know, helped me fine tune that to help people start realizing that this is a very unique Republican form of government. It's not just a representation of a bunch of people that allow people to go compromise away their skills and so forth. They're very, very tightly controlled over the powers, roles, responsibilities, and so forth. So anyway, all right. So you covered all of that. And then at the very end of this, Madison summarizes, but the powers of the federal government are enumerated. It can only operate in certain cases. It has legislative powers on defined and limited objects, which beyond, and he's talking about the federal government, not just the legislature or Congress, and limited objects, beyond which it cannot extend its jurisdiction. So even the courts cannot extend its jurisdiction beyond those enumerated objects. They can't create treaties beyond those enumerated objects. I mean, if you want to see, you know, the most succinct line, that's probably it right there. The most succinct and clear line of, you know, the hard limitations is because government has been given these enumerated objects and that's it. Now, Madison goes into money. We got about 4 minutes and you can knock this out. Because there's,
do it.
Yeah, go ahead.
When, therefore, direct taxes are not necessary, they will not be recurred to. It can be of little advantage to those in power to raise money in a manner oppressive to the people. To consult the conveniences of the people will cost them nothing, and in many respects will be advantageous to them. Direct taxes will only be recurred to for great purposes. What has brought on other nations those immense debts under the pressure of which many of them labor, not the expenses of their governments, but war. If this country should be engaged in war, and I conceive we ought to provide for the possibility of such a case, how would it be carried on? By the usual means provided from year to year, as our imports will be necessary for the expenses of government and other common exigencies, how are we to carry on the means of defense? How is it possible a war could be supported without money or credit? And would it be possible for a government to have credit without having the power of raising money? No, it would be impossible for any government in such a case to defend itself. Then I say, sir, that it is necessary to establish funds for extraordinary exigencies and to give this power to the general government for the utter inutility of previous requisitions on the states is too well known. Would it be possible for those countries whose finances and revenues are carried to the highest perfection to carry on the operation of government on great emergencies such as the maintenance of a war without an uncontrolled power of raising money? Has it not been necessary for Great Britain, notwithstanding the facility of the collection of her taxes, to have recourse very often to this and other extraordinary methods of procuring money? Would not her public credit have been ruined if it was known that her power to raise money was limited? Has not France been obliged on great occasion to use unusual means to raise funds? It has been the case in many countries, and no government can exist unless its powers extend to make provisions for every contingency. If we were actually attacked by a powerful nation, and our general government had not the power of raising money, but depended solely on requisitions, our condition would be truly deplorable. If the revenue of this commonwealth were to depend on 20 district authorities, it would be impossible for it to carry on its operations. This must be obvious to every member here. I think, therefore, that it is necessary for the preservation of the Union that this power shall be given to the general government.
Okay. Did you get anything out of this?
Oh, absolutely.
So what is the whole point of direct taxation?
To fund the government.
Well, no. It's only for the extraordinary funding, because the majority of government should be funded by the imposts. That's what he said right up here. At the very top, you said, direct taxes will only be recurred to for great purposes. In other words, he's saying, we're only going to use direct taxes for great purposes. And then Hamilton throws this side, you know, this curveball by saying, hey, I want to imply that we can create a bank and we're going to assume your debt. Now we can start direct taxing you. Instead of going to war, I mean, okay, it was for a previous war. But the point of the fact was those states had that responsibility to pay it anyway. And Hamilton used that to create a scheme of credit and bait so that he could literally pull everybody in so that everybody would be, you know, corrupted by the money. And that's exactly what he did. And then down a little bit lower, he says again, then I say, sir, that it is necessary to establish funds for extraordinary exigencies and give this power to the general government for the utter inutility of previous requisitions on the states is well known. So, again, direct taxes, folks, is strictly for being able to go and fight a war. So, with that, we've got more to cover from Madison that we're going to cover tomorrow or in our next show. So anyway, if it's tomorrow, I don't know. I don't even know if I'm coming or going. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. I know that. And we're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description version of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.